tested it. But that was not the way things were done in Washington. In the flurry of events that took place early this morning, I made a critical mistake of not informing both of you. General Flood looked to Baxter and then Roach. I will make sure that it does not happen again. Both Roach and Baxter grudgingly accepted the general's apology with a nod, but Skip McMahon was less cordial. With his gruff demeanor, which was in many ways similar to the general's, McMahon placed a big fist on the table and asked bluntly, "What else haven't you told us?" Flood and Stansfield kept their poker faces fixed, while Baxter and King shared a look that caused McMahon to ask the question again. "What else? You can't send me out there to get blindsided again. I need every advantage I can get over Aziz." Director Stansfield liked Skip McMahon. In many ways, he admired him. This was an unusual situation, however. McMahon was under an immense amount of pressure, and he was the person dealing with Aziz, the only person. Aziz had been adamant about that. Stansfield, always thinking a dozen moves ahead, did not like the idea of telling McMahon everything. The older spymaster saw a potential problem. He envisioned Aziz with a gun to a hostage's head making a demand that McMahon could not meet. He saw the dangers of telling McMahon too much, of putting McMahon in a position where he might be tempted to give Aziz some of that information in exchange for the life of a hostage. Stansfield couldn't do that. Rap was far too valuable a card in this game to start waving around for the other players to see. Stansfield observed McMahon as he stared down Baxter and King, sensing that they knew something. Knowing he had to act fast before one of them opened his mouth, Stansfield decided to kill two birds with one stone.
"There is something I should tell you."
Stansfield reached down next to his chair and grabbed the morning's copy of the Washington Post. Standing, to further draw McMahon's attention away from King and Baxter, Stansfield walked around the table and set the paper in front of McMahon. Stansfield pointed to a front-page headline that read, "CIA Saves Day by Warning Secret Service."
"How this story ever got to the Post is something that I will deal with later."
Stansfield looked across the table and gave Dallas King a knowing look.
"But in the meantime, I will bring you up to speed on a highly classified subject. We have in our possession certain intelligence that we deem to be highly accurate. That source did, in fact, provide us with the information that enabled us to alert the Secret Service to a potential attack just minutes before the actual attack took place. That source has also provided us with information pertaining to the demands Mr. Aziz will put forth, and the men and equipment he brought with him."
McMahon looked up at Stansfield, who had worked his way back to his seat.
"That's how you knew about all of the plastic explosives?"
"Yes."
"What about the demands?"
"That I am willing to share with you, but..."
Stansfield again glanced over at Dallas King.
"It is extremely confidential information that is not to be passed on to anyone."
Looking back to McMahon and Roach, he added,
"I trust both of you, so I assume you will keep this confidential."
Both of the FBI men nodded, and Stansfield said,
"Aziz's next demand will be to ask that the UN vote to lift all economic sanctions against Iraq. He is going to make a slight concession, in an effort to sound reasonable, and state that all sanctions regarding weapons of mass destruction may remain in place."
"The UN," started McMahon. "Can they move that fast?"
"If we want them to, they will," answered General Flood.
"There is one last demand."
Stansfield stopped and looked around the room, wanting to hedge his bet just a touch.
"But unfortunately, we are still trying to find out what it is."
McMahon looked at Stansfield. In all the years that he had been working for the FBI, he had never come across an individual as cool and analytical as Thomas Stansfield, on either his side of the law or the other. The man was impossible to read. McMahon turned away from Stansfield and looked immediately to his right to see if he could get anything from Kennedy. He studied her face for even the slightest clue to whether Stansfield was being forthright about the family jewels or if he was still holding out. She stared back at him blankly, just like her boss, giving nothing away. After several seconds of silence, McMahon looked across the table at Vice President Baxter and Dallas King. Before entering this meeting, Kennedy had told him that Baxter had authorized the insertion of the seals, but just minutes ago, General Flood had taken the blame for the whole mess. Either Kennedy was lying, or General Flood was covering for the Vice President. McMahon decided to play along until he could get Kennedy alone, and then he would get to the bottom of the whole thing. Dallas King took his forefinger and, as nonchalantly as possible, wiped the bead of sweat that had formed on his upper lip. He felt as if he were standing in downtown Phoenix at high noon in the middle of July. Each time someone looked at him, he wondered if they knew. Since seeing the photo of his beer-drinking buddy on CNN this morning, King had been an absolute basket case. At first, he tried to convince himself that it wasn't the same man. The guy that he drank beers with was named Mike, and he was a student. Mike didn't wear his hair slicked back like the man on the news. King tried to convince himself that it wasn't the same person, but it was futile. As he recollected his relationship with the mysterious Mike, there were too many strange coincidences. For several weeks straight, he had run into Mike everywhere he went. Mike had conveniently known all about the Stanford basketball team, King's alma mater. King closed his eyes and pinched the bridge of his nose as he remembered the evening they took the late-night tour of the White House. King remembered how Mike had claimed he had an uncle who used to work for the Secret Service under Kennedy. He convinced King to show him the Treasury Tunnel, saying that it was originally designed as a bunker during World War II. Mike told King that during the Kennedy administration, the staffers used to sneak women down into bunk rooms off the tunnel and have sex. And that's exactly what they had done that night. President Hayes was out of town, and King had no problem gaining access for his newfound friend and a couple of hot young ladies. King couldn't believe how unlucky he was. Of the hundreds of people who worked at the White House, this crazy terrorist had to pick him. Squeezing his nose even tighter, he said to himself, "How could you have fucked up so bad?" The pressure was unbelievable. He needed time to think, time to maneuver. Mitch Rapp woke up to the sound of Milt Adams snoring and a brown ponytail in his face. His left arm was pinned under Reilly's neck, and his right arm was draped across her chest. Rapp lifted his head up and tried to retrieve his right arm. This only spurred Reilly to clutch his arm tighter. How they had ended up sleeping in this embrace might have seemed a little strange, but the stash room was not particularly spacious. After the debacle earlier in the evening, Rapp had stayed on the radio with Langley until almost 4 a.m. At that time, the FBI was screaming to find out what was going on, and the entire operation was put in a holding pattern. Kennedy had ordered Rapp to get some sleep, and they would call him with orders in the morning. Rapp, in turn, had let Langley know how he felt, telling them that if they had allowed him to act when he wanted to, Aziz and the other two terrorists would be dead and one Navy SEAL would still be alive. It was no surprise to Rapp that Langley signed off without responding to his statement. Rapp then forced himself to bring it back down. He had done enough clandestine insertions to know that when you are given the opportunity to grab a couple of hours of sleep, you should take it. Rapp found comfort knowing that the next time he came across Aziz, he would shoot first and ask questions later. There would be no more checking in with Langley for the green light. Reilly had surprised Rapp by taking his arms and wrapping them around her as they lay down to go to sleep. As he drifted off, Reilly had kissed Rapp's hand and whispered something he didn't quite catch. He was more than a little surprised by the warm feeling the little kiss had given him. Now, craning his neck away from Reilly, Rapp looked at the secure field radio that was sitting between him and Adams. The overhead light was still on, and he could see just enough of the control panel to know that the radio was still on. Rapp had absolutely no idea how long he had been sleeping. He didn't want to wake, really, but saw no other choice. Taking his left hand, he reached up from under Reilly's neck and pried her hands loose. His digital watch told him it was 7:41 a.m. He'd had at least 2 hours, maybe 2.5. Rapp figured that was more than enough for now. This was hardly the time or place to be sleeping in. If Langley wasn't going to call him, he would have to call them and get things moving. Chapter 29. Rafiq Aziz was showered, shaved, and back in the expensive suit he had worn for his historic visit to the White House. All of his men were still at their posts except one. That man was standing behind a television camera in the White House press room. The morning sun spilled in from the windows running along the side of the narrow room. Aziz stood behind the familiar podium at the front of the room and checked his watch. It was nearing 8. Behind him, mounted on a blue curtain, was the White House logo. Aziz watched his man move from the camera to a control panel at the rear of the room. The man looked up from his position and yelled, "I started the 2-minute countdown. All of the networks should be receiving the feed." Aziz grinned, taking satisfaction that he was about to put into play another part of his ingenious plan. He was going to go over the heads of the military and the FBI once again. Like everything else, this had been planned. He was about to appeal to the American people, and thus the politicians. The only new touch was that he would be able to incorporate the repelling of the early morning raid into his speech. That had got him excited. It had been very close. The hostages in the building were wired to blow, and Aziz had no doubt that any attempt by the Americans to free the hostages would result in a bloodbath. That was a price he was willing to pay. He did not want it to come to that, in the interest of self-preservation, but if it did, he wouldn't hesitate for a second to annihilate everybody, including himself. The speech that he was about to give would serve to make sure that a raid by the FBI would never happen. Aziz had followed American politics closely and watched how the leaders handled conflicts, especially those with his new benefactor. Aziz had admiringly watched Saddam Hussein mimic the actions and rhetoric of Adolf Hitler. Just like Hitler in the days prior to World War II, Saddam knew how to push, pound, cajole, lie, cheat, and basically do whatever he wanted, right up to the point where his adversaries were prepared to put their foot down. Saddam had turned it into an art form, playing the weak United Nations and the political left in America and Europe for everything they were worth. Continually ignoring everything he had already agreed to, Saddam would flaunt his insolence in the face of the Western powers, and then, just as they were preparing to engage in military action, he would send his envoys to the UN. As the might of American warships and Allied air power massed at his borders, he would act defiant until the very end, and then, and only when real action was imminent, he would back down. 6 months later, the whole process would start over again, and each time the resolve of the arrogant Western powers would be weakened. Saddam had proven that the American politicians had no stomach for war. They loved their surgical strikes and cruise missiles, but were they really that effective? In Aziz's opinion, the answer was no. If one bothered to look beyond the TV clips and sound bites, the damage the surgical strikes caused was minimal. Aziz was prepared to take a cue from Saddam. In less than a minute, he would offer the American people that olive branch, and in turn the stage would be set for his last demand and his triumphant return to his country. Aziz looked toward the camera and straightened his tie. He had originally considered giving this speech from the Oval Office, but had decided it would only serve to undermine the entire intent of his plan. The American people would be livid over him sitting in the president's chair. It had been hard for him to resist the temptation to give the speech from the same place that so many other presidents had addressed the nation, especially since he would have loved nothing more than to rub the faces of the arrogant American public in the fact that he was in control of the White House. But now was not the time to prod and poke. Now was the time to pull back from the brink and get the politicians working for him. Aziz's man at the back of the room held up his hands and started the countdown. Aziz placed both hands on the podium, and when the signal was given, he cleared his throat and began to recite his speech from memory.
"It is with a heavy heart that I come to you this morning."
Looking somber and passive, Aziz stared into the camera with his dark eyes and said in perfect English,
"I wish the American people no harm, and wish for this conflict to come to a speedy conclusion. I apologize to the families of the men and women who have died in this conflict. I know that this will seem empty and hollow to many of you, but you must please understand that this is a war. A war that your military and political leaders have started. I beg you, as a nation, to ask yourselves, in front of your God, who has harmed whom in this conflict?"
Aziz stopped and looked into the camera, his face utterly devoid of aggression.
"Since the end of World War II, the West, mostly you, the Americans and your Israeli allies, has killed over 500,000 of my Arab brothers. Over 500,000 human beings."
Aziz again stopped and stared into the camera, wanting to stress this number.
"You sit here, in this great nation, with all of your wealth and comfort and technology, and you are numb to the pain and suffering that my people have gone through and continue to go through. I ask you for a moment to put yourself in my shoes, in the shoes of the Arab people. Who is the bigger barbarian? The terrorist who kills 30 people with a car bomb? Or the president who gives the order to kill thousands by sending his air force to do his dirty work? This is a question that we will probably never come to agreement on. But it is one that, at the very least, we should understand is a universal tragedy. I have not come to you today to try and place blame, but rather to make the first step in putting all of this behind us. I have come to you seeking peace. When this conflict started, I warned your FBI that any attempt to retake this building would be futile. I further warned them that such an attempt would result in the execution of hostages. Despite these warnings, your arrogant FBI tried to sneak a group of their commandos into the building last night. Their attack was repelled, just as I told them it would be, and resulted in the death of an unknown number of their people. I had intended to kill one of your fellow countrymen this morning, to punish the FBI and your leaders for their reckless actions. But I have decided to spare that person's life as an example of my good faith. I do not think it is right for an innocent person to pay with his life for the stupidity and arrogance of the small group of warmongers that runs your country. It is my sincere hope that we can resolve this conflict peacefully. And it is you, the peace-loving American people, that I am appealing to. Enough blood has been shed. It is time for us to stop living as enemies.
Pausing for a second, Aziz looked down and then back up.
But before we can do that, America must come to the Middle East peace table as a truly independent advocate, not the big brother of Israel. I have two demands left, and if those demands are met, I will give you back this great house and the people in it without further harm. The first of my demands is simple. By 6 o'clock today, The U.S. must convince the United Nations to lift all economic sanctions against Iraq. I fully understand the need to keep the blockade in place against materials that would enable Iraq to develop weapons of mass destruction, and I think those provisions should stay in place. My concern is that my Arab brothers and sisters are starving and dying because of a feud between the leaders of the West and the leaders of Iraq. This is wrong, and it should be ended. If this demand is not met by this evening, Aziz's expression turned more stern, I will be forced to kill one hostage every hour until it is met. Let me state again that any further attempt to free the hostages by force will be met with harsh punishment. With the push of one button, this whole building will crumble to the ground, killing everyone in it. Aziz continued his glare. If my demand is met by this evening, I will release half of the remaining hostages, and then I will give you my last demand. If that demand is met, Aziz shook his finger, we can spare the innocent people that have been caught in the middle of this conflict, and we can begin mending fences among our two peoples. Aziz glanced down for a second, as if searching for something special. When he looked back up, he said, I ask you, as citizens of this great nation, the greatest nation the earth has ever known, to help me make these first steps toward a lasting peace. I wish you all the best, and will pray for you. Thank you, and may your God bless you. Aziz nodded his head once, and his man at the back of the room cut the live feed. Walking quickly to his right, Aziz grabbed his MP5 and yanked at his tie. He started for the Situation Room, where he could gloat over his performance and watch the pundits dissect his every word. Vice President Baxter sat with his mouth agape, watching for the second time Aziz's nationally televised address. The heavy armor-plated presidential limousine rocked ever so slightly as it raced across the chain bridge on its way from Langley back to the Naval Observatory. A stream of motorcycles, police cruisers, sedans, vans, suburbans, and two other limousines both preceded and followed the black Cadillac. Dallas King sat next to Baxter on the spacious back seat, his digital phone held firmly to the left side of his face. King was already on his second call in as many minutes. He was in classic political crisis mode and happy to be doing something other than obsessing over the imminent demise of his short-lived career. Before Aziz's original address had concluded, King had been punching numbers into his tiny phone and barking out orders. With one eye on the small color TV in the back of the limo, he nodded his head and then said, "Now, don't waste your time asking any of the regular questions. I couldn't care less who they voted for last time if they plan on voting this time. I don't want to have to say it again. This is an issue that transcends party lines. I want the nuts and bolts, and I want them within the hour. We can go back and get specifics later." King stopped talking for a second and listened to the Democratic pollster on the other end. He started shaking his head in frustration. "You're not listening to me. I don't want you to skew the results, at least not yet. I want to get an honest feel." King listened and nodded. "That's right. After we take a stance, we can go back and push for the numbers that will back us up. But for now, I want to know what they think of this guy." King paused again and looked at the small TV. It had not been lost on King that Aziz came off very well on TV, a hell of a lot better than most of the politicians in this town. He was very well-spoken, looked sincere, and was movie star handsome to boot. "Don't forget to get me the splits on the women versus the men. The soccer moms are going to eat this guy up." King paused once again and then said, "Yep, put together a dozen questions and call me back in 5 minutes." Pulling the phone away from his face, King pushed the end button and looked to see his boss's reaction to the speech.
Baxter's expression had turned from one of surprise to a mysterious frown. King asked, "What do you think?"
"We're fucked," mumbled Baxter, without taking his eyes off the TV. "The press is going to go berserk over this failed raid."
Looking at his boss, King thought, "You think they're mad about this? Just wait until they find out I gave one of them a tour of the building last month." King gathered himself.
"The press will be fine. This story is so big and it's moving so fast, this little speech will be old news by tomorrow morning."
"I don't think so," said Baxter, not yet prepared to look at any upside. "This little incident has congressional investigation written all over it."
King looked at his boss, who was still staring at the TV with a look of defeat on his face.
"This whole thing from start to finish has congressional investigation written all over it, and this one incident will be a footnote. Besides, we insulated ourselves from it. General Flood has already taken the blame, and he did it right in front of Director Roach, the man who will eventually investigate the whole thing."
"I don't know. It still stinks."
"The whole thing stinks. You just have to remember, when this is all over, it's going to be the guy who stinks the least who comes out smelling like a rose."
King pointed at his boss.
"And I'm going to make sure that guy is you."
"Dallas," Baxter grimaced, "I don't think you're being realistic about this. All of this stuff is not just going to be swept under the rug. The press is going to want answers, and they are going to want to know if I authorized sending those men in last night."
King shifted sideways in his seat. He wanted to choke his boss and scream, "If only you had my problems." Instead, in a calming voice, he said, "For the last time, don't worry about the press. I can handle them. You need to get your spirits back up and start acting like the president. We're going to have to react to this new development, and if the polls come back the way I think they will, we really might have a chance to squeeze our way out of this mess."
Baxter turned his head toward his aide and asked, "How?"
"I haven't figured it out yet, but I will."
Baxter looked away from King and checked his watch. Then, with a sigh, he said,
"I suppose I'd better call a meeting with the National Security Council."
King nodded.
"That would seem to be the next logical step."
Baxter waved his right hand as if shooing away a fly.
"Take care of it."
"When and where?"
Twisting his lips, Baxter gazed out the window and said,
10 o'clock at the Pentagon."
Chapter 30
"You know what he's doing, don't you?" Rapp sat with the handset of the secure field radio gripped tightly in his left hand. He stared blankly at the wall in front of him while he listened to General Campbell give his take on Aziz's national address. They had played the speech for Rapp over the radio and had asked if he would like to hear it again. Rapp had declined. He knew exactly what Aziz was up to and didn't need to waste a second more analyzing it. Rapp nodded in response to what General Campbell was saying and said,
"That's right. He's trying to play you guys for patsies."
"Excuse me," replied the stern ranger on the other end.
"Patsies," repeated Rapp, never one to choose his words too carefully. "He wants Vice President Baxter and all of the other politicians up on the Hill to roll over and meet him at the bargaining table. Then, once he gets what he wants, he'll go back to the Middle East, disappear, and a year from now he'll be building more bombs and killing more people."
"What if he seriously wants to make peace?" chimed in Irene Kennedy.
"It's out of the question," Rapp replied emphatically.
"How can you be so sure?"
"Irene, don't play this game with me. I don't have the time or the patience to sit here and listen to you play devil's advocate. You know as well as I do that Rafiq Aziz could give a rat's ass about the American people, or his Arab brothers and sisters for that matter. Hell, the only Arabs he cares about are the ones that want to wipe Israel off the map. As far as the rest of us are concerned, he'd slit our throats in a second if we got in his way."
"Then what's he up to?" asked Kennedy.
Rapp sat back, swinging one of his legs out from underneath him as he thought about it.
He looked over at Reilly, propped up in the corner with the blanket wrapped around her. She was watching him intently. Looking away from her, Rapp said, "He's trying to find a way out of this without getting his head blown off. We know he's a meticulous planner. He thinks everything through from start to finish, and prepares multiple contingencies in case things go wrong. As I look at his plan, the one big problem I see is how he gets out of there, how he gets home. We can bank on the fact that he's thought it through every step of the way in terms of how we'd react. And from that, we can assume he knows there would be a strong contingency in the government that would push hard for an all-out raid. Now, if he had gotten his hands on the president, everything would be a little different. My guess is that he was planning to use Hayes as his bargaining chip to get home, but he blew it, and now he's been forced to fall back and use a different plan."
"And what would that be?" asked General Campbell.
Rapp looked up at Reilly while he thought about it. She was still staring at him with those emerald green eyes. He knew she was listening to everything he said, but there wasn't much he could do about it. Rapp looked away and said, "He's trying to manipulate the media and sway public opinion. He knows without the president he's not getting home. Let's face it." Rapp paused, feeling somewhat awkward about saying the next part in front of Reilly, but there was really no other way. After clearing his throat, he said, "If you look at the big picture, we all know every one of those hostages is expendable. And if we know it, so does Aziz. If he was to continue an aggressive, hostile position, he would eventually force us to storm the place. There is no way we could just sit by while he killed hostages on national TV. So by going in front of the public this morning and putting on this bullshit, peace-loving attitude, he's taken the wind out of our sails. Baxter won't let us take action until an effort is made at peace."
"I agree," said Kennedy. "In the end, he knows every single one of those hostages is expendable. The president was his trump card, and he didn't get it."
General Campbell added,
"He's trying to give the politicians a way out of this mess without firing a shot."
"Well, that's not going to happen as long as I have a say in the matter."
"Iron Man," stated Campbell in a firm voice, "I don't want you doing anything unless you are authorized. The last thing we need right now is you running around half-cocked. Now, Irene and I have to get over to the Pentagon for a meeting, and in the meantime, we want you to stay put. When we get back, we'll have a better idea of how we shall proceed. Am I understood?"
Rapp looked down at the floor and held his temper in check. He'd already learned his lesson. Don't ask a question if you're not going to like the answer.
"Yes, sir," was Rapp's simple two-word reply as he placed the handset back in its cradle.
Pausing for a second, he looked at the power switch and debated his next move. After about 15 seconds of indecision, he turned off the radio and looked up at Reilly. Anna Reilly sat passively in the corner with the blanket wrapped tightly around her body. Milt Adams sat in the opposite corner behind Rapp and chewed on a granola bar. Reilly continued to stare at Rapp and finally asked, "What was that all about?" Rapp glanced sideways at her as he began rifling through one of his packs.
"Nothing."
"It sure sounded like something to me," Reilly said.
"Listen, Anna, you're a reporter. I can't exactly let you in on what's going on." Reilly smiled.
"Who am I going to tell? What do you think, I'm going to call the station with your radio and give them a live update?"
Rapp grabbed several more granola bars from his pack and held one up for Reilly. "Here, chew on this." And with a grin, he added, "And stop asking questions." Reilly took the bar, and while she tore the wrapper off, asked,
"Who do you work for, Mitch Cruz? The FBI?"
No, not exactly."
"But are you then, military?"
Rapp ignored the question and continued looking for something in his pack. Reilly smiled and said,
"Hey, listen, you saved my life. I don't care who you work for."
Reilly continued to watch him. Rapp stared back for a long moment, thinking about what he should say. Finally, he replied,
"Anna, if I tell you something off the record, will you promise that you'll never report it?"
That is, since I saved your life and all. Rapp said the last part with a smile.
Really took the question seriously. I'm a reporter. Whatever you tell me in confidence will be kept a secret.
Chuckling, he said, My dad always said, don't bullshit a bullshitter. Rapp studied an abrasion on Reilly's cheek and a spot of dried blood on her lip. Changing the subject once again, Rapp pulled a penlight from his assault vest and said, Now let's see how you're doing this morning. Holding the light up in front of her face, he said, I want to check your eyes and see how your pupils dilate. Rapp held Reilly by her chin and checked the left eye first and then the right. Both dilated properly, and then he asked her to follow the light as he moved it from one side of her face to the other. Again, she checked out fine. Turning the light off, Rapp gently touched the abrasion on her cheek and asked, How does this feel? Reilly frowned and said, I don't know. How does it look? After studying her face for a second, Rapp nodded. I'd say, considering what you've been through, you look pretty good. Darn good, actually. He meant it. Reilly smiled slightly.
Well, in that case, I feel fine.
Looking back toward Adams, who was on his second breakfast bar, Rapp asked, I'd say we have a regular tough girl on our hands.
I'd say so,
replied Adams with a nod for emphasis. Rapp turned his attention back to Reilly's cheek, and when he got closer to inspect the mark, she said to him,
You know, women have a higher tolerance for pain than men.
So I've been told. Rapp fished a sterile alcohol pad from his first aid kit and tore the small package open. Gently, he started to wipe the dried blood from the corner of Reilly's mouth and then the light scrape on her cheek. When Rapp was done, he turned her head from side to side to check for any other cuts. He had not missed the obvious beauty of the reporter. He felt slightly guilty under the current circumstances for letting his mind wander, but it couldn't be helped. Her skin was soft and smooth with just the right touch of color. Rapp nudged her chin to the side and noticed a trail of dried blood that ran down the back of her neck. He wiped away the blood and then placed both hands on her scalp. Reilly flinched slightly and pulled away. Does that hurt? Asked Rapp. Reilly nodded, and Rapp said with a smile, What happened to that high tolerance for pain you were bragging about a moment ago?
I don't know, but whatever you just touched hurt like hell.
Try to hold still for a second. I want to find out how bad the cut is. Rapp lifted and separated her thick brown hair. The cut ran only about an inch, but looked to have broken the first several layers of skin. Holding one hand on her scalp, he reached behind him and grabbed another sterile alcohol pad. Without looking, he said, Milt, would you do me a favor? Take those blueprints that you brought and spread them out on the floor. Rapp wiped the cut several times and then waved his hand over the area to dry the alcohol. Reilly's face twisted in pain. After a moment, Rapp let her hair fall back down onto her shoulders and sat back on one heel. How's that? Reilly brought her hand up and gently touched her head.
I'm fine if I don't move too much.
But Rapp noticed the flicker of pain moving across her face when she raised her arm. What was that? Asked Rapp. Gently, Reilly touched her side.
Something hurts in my side.
Can you stand up for me?
I think so.
Rapp helped her up. Does it hurt on the front, the back, or the side? She gestured with her hand.
The back and the side.
I need to take a look at it. Are you all right with that? Reilly looked at Rapp's concerned face, and the corners of her mouth turned up ever so slightly. Reaching out, she placed her hand on his cheek and said,
If I can't trust you, I don't know who I could.
Rapp blushed slightly and said, Good, then turn around so I can take a look. Reilly did as she was asked, and Rapp lifted up her sweatshirt. Her skin was a golden olive from her narrow waist up, and then the discoloration began to appear. Halfway up her back, on her left side, a red mark about 4 inches long and 3 inches wide had started to form. He checked for bright red streaks and found none. Rapp touched the area softly at first, and Reilly showed no sign of pain. Then he pressed a little harder, and she winced sharply. "Can you take several deep breaths for me?" Really did so without pain, and Rap let her shirt fall. "It's probably just a bruise, which can still hurt like a bitch, but it's 10 times better than having a broken or cracked rib." With a smile, he added, "You must be one tough chick." Really smiled slightly. "I have a lot of brothers." Rap nodded. "I think you're going to be all right, but then again, I'm no doctor."
"What are you, Mr. Cruz?" asked the persistent Really.
Squeezing her shoulder, Rap said, "I got some work to do."
Turning toward the seated Adams, Rap said,
"Milt, I need you to show me every stairwell and elevator that leads from this floor to the third and from this floor to the first." Dallas King was already on his second battery. His digital phone had left his ear only momentarily over the last hour and a half. He walked at a hurried pace next to Vice President Baxter as her entourage moved down the wide hallway of the E-ring at the Pentagon. A slew of serious-looking Secret Service agents surrounded them. King thought the large contingent a bit much. They were, after all, in the Pentagon, but he had other things to worry about. As the group continued forward, the sea of people before them parted as Pentagon employees moved out of the way and clung to the walls while the current commander-in-chief passed by. The buzz level was high. Everyone had either seen Aziz's national address or heard about it. Now the natural question was, what would the U.S. government do in response? The answer was actually tied to a lone individual in Omaha, Nebraska. Reginald Boulay was his name, and at this exact moment, he was giving Dallas King the results of his Husker poll. Boulay had built up his poll over the years and made it into one of the most accurate in the political consulting business, and he only supplied it to a few well-paying clients. The members from the Husker poll were never found in the newspapers or on TV. Boulay wasn't in the business to skew results by push-polling and a variety of other techniques. He was in it to get the most accurate results possible, and he did it by asking brutally honest questions in plain English. King had decided after talking to two of his regular pollsters and being irritated at their inability to understand what he wanted that if there was ever a time to spend money on Boulay and his Husker poll, now was it. King nodded as he listened to Boulay relay the results. Although King had honestly expected them, he was nonetheless surprised. They reflected the new trend in America, almost a refusal to judge and condemn. King had sensed it while listening to Aziz's speech and wondered if he was smart enough to know what he was tapping into, or if he was just one lucky bastard. The handsome King liked what he was hearing from Boulay. According to the Husker poll, a little over 60% of those surveyed felt that Vice President Baxter should exhaust almost all options in an effort to resolve the crisis in a peaceful way. When it came to lifting economic sanctions against Iraq, except those involving weapons of mass destruction, the numbers jumped to almost 80%. As Boulay had explained it to King, "There's about 20% of the population that would just as soon level the White House before giving these terrorists a thing, and nothing you do or say will change that." King had also expected that. The zealots at either end of the spectrum would always be around. They were not the people you had to worry about. The rest of the populace was whom he had to keep his eye on, the 60 to 80% of the people who were not too far from the middle on any given issue. As a political advisor, King saw it as his job to try and get those people leaning in his direction, or, more precisely, to position his boss in the middle of them. That would be his next course of action. After asking Boulay to fax him the results, King ended the call and brought the vice presidential armada to a screeching halt. Grabbing his boss by the arm, King stopped at the next door on the right and pulled Vice President Baxter over with him. The Secret Service agents were used to this type of semi-private consultation between their charges and their aides, and without having to say a word, they turned their backs to the Vice President and deployed in a protective shell. King placed a hand on Baxter's shoulder and said in a whisper, "It's just like I thought.
Over 60% of the people want to see a peaceful resolution to this mess. And almost 80% think we should lift the economic embargo against Iraq just so long as the military embargo is kept in place. Baxter nodded and said,
So we're safe if we push for the UN to raise the sanctions?
I think so, said King with confidence. Besides, if we can get him to release another third of the hostages, we'll be in a really good position to get some mileage out of this. Baxter pointed down the hall toward the direction of the room they'd be meeting in.
They aren't going to like this.
King shrugged. They're not going to like anything short of storming the place with a battalion of commandos. You have to prevent that from happening. You have to take the higher moral ground. You have to protect the lives of those innocent hostages.
What about policy? What about precedence? Baxter shook his head. We think the American people are behind it, but what about the Hill? There are going to be some hardliners up there who are going to scream bloody murder over this. Hell, some of them are already pissed that we gave them the Iranian money.
Fuck 'em, snarled King. They're gonna hate you no matter what you do, and if you do what they want and send in the troops, you're gonna have a group of hardliners from the left trying to crucify you. King shook his head. You can't please both groups. You have to stay with the majority of public opinion and stick with your base. That's where your protection is.
It was Baxter's turn to shake his head.
That's comforting. Public opinion, which you are so infatuated with, is about as predictable as the weather.
Baxter continued shaking his head.
Public opinion is like a mob. It's fine just so long as you can predict where it's going, but the second you screw up and they turn on you, you're screwed.
King looked at his boss, his eyes sagging. He had been working non-stop for the last 3 days. He was tired, he was sick of hearing his boss whine, and he had bigger problems of his own.
Sherman, King's face twisted into an expression of contempt, maybe you should just quit. If you can't see that we have a golden opportunity here to build you up as a great statesman, as the man who saved the day, as the politician who stepped in and brokered the peace during the biggest crisis this nation has faced in possibly, King paused while shaking his head, its entire history? Then maybe you really should just let General Flood and Director Stansfield and the rest of the warmongers storm the place, destroy that great building, and kill all of the people in it. And then you can go down in the history books as the butcher who sent 50 Americans to their death because he was afraid to step up to the plate.
Baxter stood silently and looked at his chief of staff. He was not used to being spoken to in such a manner by anyone, not even a peer. This was probably the principal reason why King's word sank in. It was true, Baxter thought to himself. If he wanted to be president some day, which he did, badly, more than anything in the world, he would have to stand up and be a leader. Slowly, he started to nod in an affirmation of King's words.
Chapter 31 General Flood, General Campbell, Director Stansfield, and Irene Kennedy were all sitting next to each other at one end of the long table of the Joint Chiefs' briefing room. Across from them sat the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of State, both with one aide. When Vice President Baxter entered, he and Dallas King sat at the head of the table with the other members to their immediate left and right, leaving over two-thirds of the massive table's seats unoccupied. The crisis was wearing on everyone. Eyes were bloodshot, and hands were a little shaky from either a lack of sleep or too much coffee or both. Vice President Baxter folded his unsteady hands and placed them on the table. His kick in the pants from King had given him a newfound sense of focus and determination. Instead of asking for opinions, Baxter looked to the Secretary of State and said,
"Charles, I want you to light a fire under the UN's ass and get this vote taken care of before the end of the day."
Secretary of State Charles Middleton bowed his head and asked,
"How much pressure may I use?"
"As much as you want. Threaten to veto every resolution midway into the next century. Threaten to pull all funding. Just do whatever it takes to get the vote passed by the end of the day."
Once we get the hostages released, we can always go back later and pass a reversing resolution.
It might not be that easy, warned Middleton as he adjusted his glasses.
I don't care, get it done, and we'll worry about the rest of it later.
Director Stansfield cleared his throat.
Excuse me, aren't we getting a bit ahead of ourselves?
Baxter's head snapped to his left. He wasn't in the mood to debate anything. He was only in the mood to give orders and have them followed. But now, as he looked across the table at the cool and grandfatherly Thomas Stansfield, his newfound confidence wavered just a touch. Stansfield was quite possibly the most harmless-looking individual that Baxter had ever met, but the rumors about the old spymaster caused one to think twice before locking horns with him. Baxter eased back several inches and asked,
"How do you mean, Thomas?"
"I think it would be prudent if we analyzed what was said and then decided on a course of action."
"I feel that I have all the information I need to make this decision. Aziz is willing to deal. Deal for American lives. And in return, we will have to give in and do something that, as humanitarians, we should probably do anyway."
"And what would that be?" asked General Flood in an uneasy tone.
"Stop starving the Iraqi people."
"We," started an irritated General Flood, "are not starving the Iraqi people. Saddam Hussein is starving his own people by refusing to comply with the terms of surrender for a war that, I'd like to remind everybody, he started."
Flood stabbed his thick forefinger at the surface of the table.
"We have confirmed intelligence reports that Saddam has funded Aziz with the express purpose of carrying out a terrorist attack on U.S. soil. With that information, how can we even consider asking the UN to lift the sanctions?"
"We don't know for sure if those reports are accurate," retorted the Vice President.
Thomas Stansfield looked the Vice President squarely in the eye and said,
"I would stake my entire career and reputation on the validity of that information."
Baxter felt himself losing ground. Leaning all the way back in his chair, he brought his hands up and said,
"I'm not going to sit here and defend Saddam Hussein. I hate the man. I find him despicable. But what I want to do is free as many hostages as we can, and then we can go back later and fix things."
"Fix things?" Flood was getting angrier. "What if we can't go back and fix things?"
"I think almost everybody will recognize that we were forced to make some decisions under duress. Hell, basically with a gun to our head."
Flood moved his glare from the Vice President to the Secretary of State, who was sitting directly across the table.
"Charlie, how badly do the French want to get back into Iraq?"
The Secretary of State replied without enthusiasm, but bluntly,
"Badly."
"How about the South Africans?"
"Badly."
"How about Russia?"
"Badly."
"Do you have any reason to believe that after we've opened the gate, they would turn around a week or a month from now and pull back out?"
"I doubt it. They've been itching to get the embargo lifted for years, and they're already doing a fair amount of business with them on the sly."
Flood turned back to Baxter.
"It won't be that easy to just reverse course when and if this whole mess is resolved."
"I know there is nothing easy about this, General." Baxter knew he had to reassert his authority. "You don't need to explain the obvious to me. My number one concern is the lives of the American citizens that are being held hostage. If I have to change a foreign policy that isn't even working to gain their freedom, I will gladly do so."
Baxter tilted his head back indignantly.
"You would jeopardize the entire foreign policy and national security of this country for the lives of 40 to 50-some people?"
"I think you're being a little melodramatic, General Flood."
"Melodramatic?"
Flood repeated the word while his face reddened.
"This is a war, Vice President Baxter. And in war, there are casualties. Saddam Hussein has attacked us. He has paid this terrorist, this mercenary..."
Flood flipped his hand in disgust.
"Call him what you want, to come and attack us.
Men like Saddam and this Aziz only understand one thing, and that is force. Overwhelming force.
Baxter looked at the general with scorn for challenging him. Disagreement was one thing, but this was a show of disrespect. General Flood, your opinion has been noted. Now, if we could move on to some other issues.
Sir, stated the general loudly, if, or more accurately, when it becomes known that Saddam had a hand in this whole mess, the American people are going to want action, and there will be some uncomfortable questions asked of those who were making the decisions.
Baxter's temper began to unravel.
Are you threatening me, General Flood?
No. Flood stared him right in the eye. I am merely once again stating the obvious. We are not the only country in possession of this information. Some of our most faithful allies know what is going on, and they will not sit idly by while we jeopardize their security.
General Flood! Bellowed Baxter, his temper finally getting the best of him. Do I need to remind you how the chain of command works? I am in charge here,
Baxter pointed to himself,
and I am going to put the interests of those hostages above everyone else's, especially those of another country, whether they be an ally or not.
Flood did not flinch. He did not twitch. He did not move a muscle. He simply returned the vice president's stare and said,
First of all, I am very aware of the chain of command. And secondly, I would be derelict in my duty if I didn't inform you that you couldn't be more wrong in ignoring the national security of our allies. Israel has been one of our staunchest. In your effort to find a short-term solution, you are, in my opinion, moving one of our closest allies and possibly this entire nation toward war.
Before Baxter had a chance to come completely unglued and Flood had a chance to elaborate, the door opened and a female naval officer entered. She apologized to the group and approached Irene Kennedy. The officer handed Kennedy a piece of paper and left. Dr. Kennedy opened the paper and studied the note. It concerned a little issue completely forgotten about. Desperately wanting to find out what her counterpart had to say, she stood and said, "If you'll excuse me, I need to check on this." Kennedy waved the note in the air and left the room. Mitch Rapp had everything ready to go. Bringing Adams along had proven to be a big help, not only because of his knowledge of the building, but also because it gave Rapp an extra set of very capable hands. Adams had just finished showing Rapp the exact spots for a third time. Rapp looked at the layout of the second floor one last time and double-checked the number. When he was done, he had come up with 5 different locations. Turning to Adams, he said, "Do you think you can handle the monitor and the devices at the same time?" Adams nodded.
"Yep."
"Good. That'll free me up to keep an eye out for any surprises." Rapp then grabbed the small fanny pack and took out all of the micro-surveillance units except 5. Handing the pack to Adams, he pointed at the blueprints and said, "We'll place them in the 5 locations you suggested. After we put each one in place, we'll check it on the monitor and make sure it's working." Rapp then grabbed the monitor and helped Adams get strapped into it. When he was done helping Adams, he began checking out the rest of his gear. As Rapp slid the bolt on his submachine gun back, Reilly asked, "Is that an MP5? Rapp looked up, frowning, more than a little surprised that she could even make a guess, let alone get the manufacturer correct.
"Close. It's the new MP10.
How do you know what an MP5 looks like?"
"My dad's a police officer in Chicago."
"Oh, that's right."
"What are you going to do?"
"A little reconnaissance."
"Where?"
Rapp placed the submachine gun on the ground.
"You sure do ask a lot of questions."
"I'm a reporter. It's my job."
Rapp frowned and nodded as if he had just been reminded of a particularly bad thing. Reilly picked up on the expression and asked,
"Is there something wrong with that?"
"Normally." Rapp shrugged his shoulders. "Probably not. But under the current circumstances, I can see where we might have a problem."
"And why would that be?"
Why? Rapp tilted his head. Because when this whole thing is over, you will probably have one hell of a story to tell.
I owe you a lot. I wouldn't report anything that you didn't agree to.
Rapp slid his pistol out of his thigh holster and pulled back on the slide. The cylindrical brass round was where it should have been, and Rapp let the slide go forward. What if I don't want you to